This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The U.S. has become an outlier because, unfortunately, one of our political parties has been captured by a radical anti-science agenda that says instead of following the best science, we're going to simply turn this into a partisan issue. That's a disaster for this country and because of the U.S. leadership for the world. And I look forward to the day when both parties, again, are nonpartisan on issues of the environment.
Many of us would like to be at the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, kicking off this week in Paris. Well, today on Sea Change Radio, we've got the next best thing. Alex Levinson is the Executive Director of Pacific Environment, an organization focused on environmental efforts in the Pacific Rim and the Arctic, and a Paris Summit participant. I recently sat down with Levinson at Pacific Environment's San Francisco headquarters to discuss the goals and expectations of the Paris conference, how other Pacific Rim powers such as China and Russia view the climate change denial movement in the U.S., and the mess that humans have made of an already fragile Arctic ecosystem. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Alex Levinson. He's the Executive Director of Pacific Environment. Alex, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here, Alex.
Why don't you tell us what Pacific Environment is, the group, before we dive into some of the issues I want to cover today.
Great. Pacific Environment's a nonprofit environmental group, almost 30 years old. Our tagline is that we protect the living environment of the Pacific Rim. And what that really means is that we protect the wildlife and the wild places and the people who live in these locales. Where our focus on communities means that we place great stock in local people making local decisions about what their environment should be like and what development decisions should happen.
We've done pieces here on Sea Change Radio recently about trying to find either relocation or find solutions for indigenous peoples in isolated villages up in Alaska. And we've also done a lot of pieces delving into animal conservation issues, particularly in the Arctic. What kind of mix does Pacific Environment end up working on in terms of people versus animal preservation?
For us, the two are truly inextricably intertwined. We are a conservation group. We care an enormous amount about survival of, for example, the marine mammals that are in great peril as the summer sea ice begins to melt in the Arctic. But at the same time, there are coastal communities there that have lived there for tens of thousands of years and have relied on and built their traditions around interactions and subsistence on marine mammals. And we support the indigenous communities and their survival. And in doing so, we're strongly in favor and supportive of trying to have marine mammals and the wildlife ecology thrive.
And you and some of your colleagues are going to be sending a delegation over to Paris for the upcoming climate summit. Why don't you talk about what your goals are and what you're doing?
Great, thanks. The Paris climate meetings are the next iteration of the international community coming together and trying as an international community to take steps and make progress to combat climate change. This can't be done without the international community at the state level happening. But it also can't succeed with only the state level. And one of the things groups that we do, nonprofit environmental groups around the world do, is work together to bring local voices to Paris so that the world hears and understands the impacts of climate change, that use of coal, that use of oil is having right now in local communities. So what we're doing in Paris is we have a number of Russian partners who wanted to come tell their stories about how coal use affects their public health and their communities. And then it got even better because we're collaborating now with other countries' environmental groups, and we'll be co-hosting a film festival with documentary films from Russia, China, the Philippines, Australia, and South Africa, each of which is going to tell a story about how local people are being harmed by the use of coal.
this is educational, or is there an activist bent where there's a specific goal that you're hoping, or some kind of narrative that you're trying to carve for the attendees?
It's both. It's strongly educational, because I think bringing out these stories is among the most important ways that we remind people that these have real, that climate change that can sound so abstract, or protection of the environment, involves real people, involves coastal villages, involves people in the middle of Siberia, involves people living in China where they have life expectancy cut by 5 years, according to an MIT study. And so bringing their stories, I think, makes a material difference in the inclination of people to do something, including the state attendees at these meetings. And the activism is to keep pushing the attendees to make sharper and better progress than they're making.
And how do you interface with governments? What popped in my head when you mentioned you have somebody from the Paris delegation talking about the perils of coal? Russia is largely a petrostate in many ways. So how do you interface with a government like Russia when you're trying to talk about Arctic drilling and the perils that face indigenous people in Siberia, for example?
We and folks who work in Russia right now are having an exceedingly hard time. There's no sugarcoating it, that Vladimir Putin's Russia is beginning to reflect the kind of Russia that Russians once knew under Stalin. It's been very hard for civil society groups and nonprofit groups to succeed these days. At the same time, the folks who do the work there are incredibly courageous and continue to push hard to protect their ways of life and protect the salmon and protect walruses and tigers and creatures that they care about. And sometimes they get support from Russian local governments and even sometimes from the federal government on these issues. We've been having more success in China, where the central government there right now seems very committed to making a dent on the horrific levels of air and water pollution that Chinese people face from use of coal and other industrial processes. And it's a happy moment, in a sense, because the central government has trouble getting the provinces to follow all of its mandates. One of the things that local grassroots environmental groups do and environmental leaders do in China is help push the local government simply to enforce the law that Beijing says that Beijing creates against coal plants or other kind of polluters. So we spend a lot of time working with local groups on how they can help improve enforcement.
And what are some of the outcomes that Pacific Environment and other people who care greatly about the environmental hazards facing us in the polar regions, what kind of outcome should we hope for from Paris? Are there any laws, tariffs, treaties, alliances that we need to be rooting for?
I think the starting point is we're going into Paris with much greater momentum than we've gone into other international meetings in the last decades.
Namely Copenhagen, where things kind
where
of
Copenhagen,
fell flat, right?
That's right. In Copenhagen, things went very badly, and I think it left everyone demoralized. And two things have changed. First of all, I just mentioned greater momentum, and I'll say more about that. And secondly, I think everybody's more mature now and realizes Paris isn't the single place. Paris is part of a long-term transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. And Paris can be a significant step on the way, but it's only a step also. We've made immense progress in the last 5 years and 10 years in turning the world coal economy into a clean energy economy. You have coal plants that their stock prices are as low as they've ever been. Many coal plants, coal companies are going bankrupt. Many mega coal projects on the books around the world are being scrapped. And even while there's still enormous amounts to do, and anybody could point out exceptions to what I said, mega coal projects getting built, the trend is tremendously favorable. And we go into Paris with China and the U.S. having just signed bilateral agreements that are concrete and tangible. Not enough, but concrete and tangible, with President Obama having produced a clean power plan that materially goes after coal plants around the country, and then more symbolic things like canceling the XL Keystone Pipeline.
And as the night danced by, A kiss became a sigh. Your lovely eyes seemed to sparkle just like wine does. No heart ever yearned the way that mine does for you. And yet I know too well, someday you'll say goodbye. Then violins will cry, and so will I, mademoiselle.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Executive Director of Pacific Environment, Alex Levinson. So, Alex, as somebody who works with international governments and bodies on a daily basis, can you give us some kind of insight into how these governments, which you just mentioned, Russia is reverted in many ways back to its communist era state in many ways. How do these actors, supposedly irrational, view the climate science denying movement coming from the right wing here in this country? Does something like this exist? Are there parallels in other countries?
The U.S. has become one of the outliers on this issue. You start with the fact that virtually all scientists who are climate experts are in consensus about climate change happening and being caused largely by humans at this point. Of course, science always is going to have issues, questions around the details and the nuances of how fast and how slow and what actions. But many of the models, it's turning out, are too conservative, and that many of the changes that we're experiencing globally are happening faster than the models predicted. And of course, in California, the models predicted that we would have droughts and that we would have much smaller snowpacks. And as our governor said, we're beginning to see a new normal in California. This kind of new normal is happening all over the world in whatever kind of the changes in rainfall, changes in climate conditions, droughts, and happening faster than we think. So the models are telling us the models are conservative, and that the actual climate change that we're observing is happening faster. The U.S. has become an outlier because, unfortunately, one of our political parties has been captured by a radical anti-science agenda that says instead of following the best science, we're going to simply turn this into a partisan issue. That's a disaster for this country and because of the U.S. leadership for the world. And I look forward to the day when both parties, again, are nonpartisan on issues of the environment.
So there are no other governments that you work with that just have their head in the sand or saying, nope, the science isn't really in?
Russia is one of the countries that is not in the lead yet on climate change.
Are they actively denying it, though? For example, like the right wing in this country has paid millions and millions of dollars to fund these studies that show that up is down and down is up.
You know, the Russian government's a bit of a black box, so I'm not really sure what their attitude is. What I can tell you that I find a lot is that when I'll talk to average Russians and Russian non-climate scientists and Russian lawyers, a lot of times I'll get an answer that is the kind of thing you would have heard maybe in Minnesota 15 years ago. People will say, well, we're a cold country, so if climate change happens, things will be warmer here, which is, you know, a starting point, but not a very serious analysis of what's going to happen in Russia when you have extreme weather events and much colder winters in certain places and warmer in other places.
So talk about some of the realities in the Arctic right now. We get dribs and drabs from documentary films, but you and your colleagues are there and studying and working with scientists to sound the alarm.
That's right. So the most important change in the Arctic, folks will remember there's a North Pole, and the North Pole consists of ice cover, and it recedes and melts throughout the summer, and it gets bigger and bigger throughout the winter. That ice is beginning to melt such that there'll be open ocean, really a new ocean. The Arctic Ocean is emerging from ice, and where scientists had once predicted that it would emerge as early as 2050. You're even seeing some scientists saying it will emerge completely ice-free summer, lack of summer sea ice, as early as 2020. So this is happening very fast.
That's 5 years from now.
That's right. And there are a host of threats that are going to happen in the Arctic because of development interests wanting to rush in what they see as a
new gold rush, almost.
A new gold rush, and some of them call it the Arctic imperative. So you have fossil fuel issues, attempts to drill oil and gas and coal. You have shipping. So transportation is always one of the drivers of development. If you build a road into a forest, then it opens in the Amazon. That opens it up for logging companies, and behind them residential companies and drilling. In the Arctic, the transportation routes are by shipping and ports. And so you have many, many shipping interests, whether they be cruise boats or shipping companies or oil drilling companies, that now see the Arctic in the summer without ice as a transportation route. And then you have fishery issues, because the Arctic Ocean has largely not even been mapped, and we don't even know the ecology of fish migrations in and out of it. And so commercial fish industry could come in and devastate things before we even understand them. So fisheries, oil and fossil fuel drilling, and shipping, transportation, are the three great threats to the Arctic right now.
Are they purely threats, or can we work with these interests as allies? Because they can profit from the realities of the climate. If there are going to be open waterways in 5 years, stakes are already being claimed, I imagine.
That's right. Well, the good news is that the Arctic is an area where the environmental movement, the environmental coalitions that work together, have done some good things with help of international community, international nations, and some industries. So there are preliminary agreements among some of the key Arctic nations, Russia, the U.S., Canada, and others, to regulate fishing and fisheries on the high seas, and especially until we know more about what are the actual ecology of fish breeding and migrations through the newly open Arctic waters. So I'm surprisingly confident that on the fishery issues, we've made some really good progress. Secondly, on the transportation issues, just recently a new international accord was reached to regulate shipping on both of the poles, North Pole and South Pole. So it's called the Polar Code because it regulates the two codes. And it's got some really good things in there, telling ships they can't dump garbage any longer in these polar waters, telling them that they can't do certain kinds of pollution, and something I'm particularly proud of that Pacific Environment helped get, telling ship captains that when they begin a ship, they have to use real-time data to find out where whales and other marine mammals are and avoid them. So that's huge. And many of the shipping interests said they couldn't do that. And one of the things we did is come in and show them and bring evidence in that there is, in fact, real-time data that exists now that tracks where whales might be congregating, where coastal indigenous villages might be hunting. Again, you don't want to harass them or the whales. The takeaway for your listeners on this is that the international community has recognized through the Polar Code that Arctic waters deserve special protection beyond the protections that oceans everywhere need, but that Arctic waters are special. The third issue, which really wasn't one that came because of any kind of international accord, was oil drilling. Many listeners may know that Shell tried very hard to drill in the Arctic offshore, and that's been a battle that we've been fighting and many environmental allies have been fighting for almost a decade. And just now, a couple of weeks ago, Shell finally threw in the towel. And that's a hugely important thing because the Arctic simply can't, no matter what you do, if you have an oil spill in the Arctic, remember in the Gulf, it went on for a few months before they could cap it. In the Arctic, it could go on the entire dark winter where you have the ice closing in and darkness, and you might not be able to cap it at all for a year.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Levinson. He's the executive director of Pacific Environment. So observers of Shell, quote-unquote, throwing in the towel, some point towards lower oil prices right now where it just might not have been as profitable for Shell to embark on a pretty capital-intensive extraction process. And on the other hand, there's people who say, well, there just may not have been as much oil as Shell's petrogeologists had originally estimated, and so they were kind of backing off. What should environmentalists take away from the action of Shell stepping away? Is this a template for more conservation in the area, or do you view it as maybe more of an aberration?
Well, I think there are two takeaways. First of all, the Arctic is, as we try to leave fossil fuels in the ground, which is really the only solution to climate change, you don't want to open up new vistas in places like the Arctic that are dangerous to drill in, dangerous for wildlife, dangerous for people who live there, and damaging to their ways of life. Frankly, it's nutty to open up a new vista like that, new areas where you haven't drilled before. And we've stopped Shell, but there's still more to be done because we really need to make a permanent ban on drilling offshore in the Arctic regions. And so there are 5-year plans that the U.S. is considering for selling leases to other companies, and we need to stop those. That said, there's even a bigger takeaway, I think, on what's important about this, which is, of course, I think your listeners know we shouldn't be endangering the environment and people with this kind of drilling. But also, there are very strong economic reasons we shouldn't be doing this as well. Coal doesn't make sense when you consider the cost of life expectancy reduction from its use and the immense amounts of medical costs it does. Oil drilling doesn't make sense when you consider the costs of enormous oil spills. One of the things that the environmental movement has done better and better is when the economics are bad on these things, we've pushed hard and tried to change the inertia that often has these projects moving forward, even when they no longer make any economic sense.
And what are some of the best inflection points to hit on there? How do you change the viewpoint of these oil giants?
I don't know if you change their viewpoint, but you do change the viewpoint of the decision makers, many of whom often, because of the revolving door, may have come from that industry and think that building a new power plant is the way to bring electricity to a city, or drilling for more oil is the way to get more power for our cars. And you keep pushing at the illogic often of their economic models and their scientific models, whether it be convincing that public utilities commission that it's going to be a lot cheaper for their ratepayers to build new wind turbines or solar power on people's rooftops, or even at times a natural gas plant rather than a large coal plant. And one example from Alaska that strikes me as representative of just how nutty the arguments can be on these conditions. When President Obama visited Alaska in September, Alaskan Governor Walker, who's an independent, not a Republican, not a Democrat, kept announcing in the press that he would push President Obama to open up natural gas. And his reason was because he said, we in Alaska need revenues to relocate the villages that are being flooded by climate change.
And then the threat of methane gas release within permafrost as these polar ice caps begin to melt. Why don't we delve into that for a moment? What is your organization doing to not only raise awareness, but to try to find some solutions?
Well, the Arctic does have a number of dramatic changes that can happen, that are happening, and that each of which might be a tipping point. Methane gas release is one of them. As the Arctic warms, the permafrost, which was frozen tundra essentially, is beginning to release methane gas. Methane is one of the most potent and quick-acting climate change gases, greenhouse gases. And so the scientific way to stop it would be to very quickly stop the warming of the Earth. Even the 2 degrees that we're talking about may or may not be sufficient to stop methane gas release from the permafrost. That's the great danger of climate change, that there are tipping points we may hit that create feedback loops. Essentially, the methane is released, it then warms the earth even more, releasing more methane, and you get a feedback loop that just becomes its own spiral that you can't stop.
So everything could feed into acceleration of these issues.
Right. I mean, a second issue that's also happening in the Arctic because of global warming is that as the Arctic sea ice melts, we're losing all of the albedo effect, all of the effect of that white ice reflecting the sun's heat back into space. Instead, it now is getting absorbed by the oceans. That heat being absorbed by the oceans is going to drive further warming and further acidification of the oceans. So we're facing, I mean, nobody should underestimate the threat of global warming and climate change for us on a host of issues. And the Arctic is one of those areas that demonstrates graphically through release of methane, through loss of sea ice, through effects on global ocean currents, just how dangerous it is what we're doing. Many of the solutions in the Arctic, to these effects in the Arctic, have to do with global solutions for climate change. At the same time, in the Arctic, you can do, and we're working on what people call climate adaptation as well. Even in a world in which you're slowing down climate change, if the ice is going away, you face an existential threat to ice-dependent creatures. And we'd like to focus the world on, even as we're stopping climate change, making sure we do everything we can to protect wildlife, wild places, and the people who live in these places. And their ways of life.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Levinson. He's the Executive Director of Pacific Environment. When we're talking about feedback loops, we should also consider the Arctic and the rest of the planet. That line is becoming blurred more than ever, isn't it?
That's right. Ecologically, we're seeing great migrations in the Northern Hemisphere northward and in the Southern Hemisphere southward as the Earth warms. As the Earth warms, we're also seeing in mountain ecology, every mountaintop is becoming an island that's becoming smaller and smaller. I was hiking in the Sierra Nevada. We usually won't see any rattlesnakes above 6,000 feet, and I'm seeing them at 8,500 feet. Everybody else is reporting those kind of things too. As these rattlesnakes get up higher and higher on the mountain, as the mountain warms, at some point they reach a place they can't go any higher. And so every mountain becomes an island that becomes smaller and smaller.
He's the Executive Director of Pacific Environment, Alex Levinson. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by George Benson, Frank Sinatra, and the Grateful Dead.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.